Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about the undead. You know, there's a huge number of roles from mindless hordes to supernatural masterminds. They've changed a lot over the editions, so we're going to dig into the design, how to use them, and a whole lot more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I will remind everyone that, as always, I believe, at the end of the show will be our after-party chat. Now, personally, I won't be there, Dan, but you will still be there to hold it today?
I am really looking forward to hearing what our patrons' additional thoughts about the undead are today, so yes.
Excellent. So, just so folks know, who may be new to the show, the After Chat is a live video chat hosted by us on our private Discord channel, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you will get an invite to our Discord server. Get that all set up before the end of the show, and around 10 or 15 minutes after the show, our live video chat will be hosted there on our Discord server.
We have the best, smartest patrons in the business, Paul, and they're also highly attractive. So we love getting to interface with them all the time on our Discord server, including folks, and they're so helpful, like Vacuous for checking in that we're currently live on Twitch, YouTube, and Restreambot. So thank you for that, of course. So why are we talking about undead? So a couple of reasons. I'm noticing now that advertising and store placement for Halloween stuff is now starting in mid-August. So I think around August 20th, like, I'm starting to get plastered with Halloween ads, and there's a store around the corner from me that has this giant, you know, horrible werewolf, 8-foot werewolf models that make sounds that you can buy if you want to. And it's not my favorite thing. Can I say this? There is a completely lunatic neighbor on the next block that has the most insane. You've never seen anything like it. The most insane Halloween getup on his house every year, and he escalates it more and more and more and more every year. It's just too freaking much. Anyway, some people love that stuff. More power to them. So that is partly on my mind at the moment as we dive into that season.
Yeah. Also, you know, we've done a few targeted shows in the past about some specific undead. I think we did a show on vampires. We've talked about liches, although I think that was kind of accidental by root of
Correct.
The magic jar spell.
Correct.
But we never talked about the undead as a whole.
You're right.
Yeah.
Viewers should go back, and we have had.
We keep talking about each other.
Individual episodes. I'm so sorry, Paul. We have had individual episodes on vampires, one on ghouls, and one combined on wights, wraiths, and specters that are all kind of the same thing in D&D. So, yeah, you can go back to individual episodes on those topics in the past.
Yeah, so I thought it would be interesting to look at them as a whole, both just because of, I think it's unusual, I think, to have a group of monsters in the game like this that vary so much across their power spectrum. And then also, like, they're a little intrinsically tied to the class of the cleric via the turning capabilities of the cleric. And that's an interesting thing for us to talk about, I think, Dan, because, of course, you don't play with clerics, and I often follow suit. So that's interesting.
I don't.
Dan, I want to begin by, I'm going to put up, since I pulled the Band-Aid off on that, I'm going to put up real quick a chart from the first edition AD&D Dungeon Master's Guide. This is the matrix for cleric turning undead. And I find this chart very interesting for a variety of reasons. But one is just, and this is so silly, but just the shading they did, right? Because, you know, it's just supposed to help you read the chart a little bit better. Every three rows is a different, you know, alternates between kind of gray and white background. But the grouping is significant, I think. Accidentally, I'm sure. But you sort of have the lowest level undead in the first group, And they're all, well, okay, maybe not the ghoul, but generally they're falling into this realm of just complete mindless automatons, you know, zombies, skeletons, shambling at you, kill, kill, kill. Okay, the ghoul maybe starts to transition us into the second group, which includes Shadow, White, Ghost. Yeah. Okay, maybe that's a little unusual. But you get into these more feral, like, they're destructive, they want to kill you. But probably, I don't know about you, Dan, but I've never played a game with, like, say, a Shadow or a White. In a game where the players talked to the creature, right? They're a little more autonomous, I guess, but they're not so intelligent that we're expecting to have discourse with them.
Right. True. Yep. True.
Right. Yeah. Now, okay. The next group, we get into Wraith, Mummy, Spectre. Okay. Can you talk to a Wraith or a Mummy or a Spectre? Maybe a Spectre. Maybe a Ghost. Right. That's kind of in that realm of like. They're getting more intelligent. They're maybe trapped.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
oftentimes I think of like specters and ghosts as being like something that's haunting a location, and maybe there's some interesting puzzle or piece of history for you to figure out. They're still pretty angry according to the monster manual. They still want to kill you, typically. Right. And then you get into the final group, our final group here, which is I'm sorry, I think I misread Ghast as Ghost there. That's a Ghast in the second group, isn't it?
Correct,
Ghost is
correct.
In the third group. Along with Vampire and Lich. And now you get into, like, actual intelligent, I was going to say life, but not really life, unlife, right? You get the real super intelligent undead that have plans, can be, like, major nemeses for the players who are, you know, have their own, you know, things going on, and maybe you're going to have a conversation with them, maybe, or an argument or something. Anyway, I just found that very interesting of sort of this progression of both power and intelligence, or maybe not intelligence, but autonomy? I can't say that word today. Of having like autonomous free will-ish.
Right, right, right. The other thing, so good point on that. The other thing that I point out is that there tends to be a common thread of there tends to be some kind of long-term draining effect theme for many of them. So the, again, kind of starting in that second tier that you're pointing out. So shadows drain strength points is what they do. Most of the stuff in the middle of the chart drains energy levels in original D&D or for second edition, just drain your character levels away permanently. So the Whites, Wraiths, Spectres, Vampires all do that. The Ghost in classic D&D drains, ages you, takes away years of your life by aging you. And then there's also a common thread of like many of them will spawn, which means that if they eliminate a player character, then they come back as a controlled lower level undead commonly. So there tends to be mummies, right, hit you with the mummy rot, which is a long-term thing that prevents you from healing. Really.
Yep.
So there tends to be some kind of like we're long-term semi-permanently draining your vitality away, and that's going to linger for possibly a long time, possibly permanently, unlike most other monsters in classic D&D.
I wonder about like when you think about the origins of these monsters, right? A lot of them have origins in specific fiction or other media, right? Your skeletons, your zombies, plenty of zombie movies out well before, I'm sure, Dungeons and Dragons came along. Ghost stories have been around forever. Of course, Dracula for your vampire, right? So a lot of these creatures pre-exist in some kind of, with most D&D, right? Most monsters are coming from some origin like this. But I feel like rarely does... especially in early D&D, rarely did they try to like group the monsters together like this. Like somebody said, "Oh, these are all undead." Like, is that a D&Dism? Is that just a cultural thing of like that we've decided that things that are somehow beyond or made of human parts that were once alive and are now dead is a thing?
Well, that's a good question where that comes from, actually.
So here's the weird counterpoint brought up on our Discord earlier,
right?
Is your flesh golem, which is I think we can all agree probably inspired by Frankenstein, that undead made up of formerly living body parts. It doesn't really show up on the chart here, and I think we'd all be surprised if a flesh golem got turned by a cleric.
Yeah, certainly that's we all know that that isn't per the D&D rules. So just looking very quickly, and this is coming back because I think I've seen this before. So what I'm seeing is that using the word undead for these kinds of, you know, dead evil spirits is basically thanks to Bram Stoker. Dracula was almost titled The Undead by Bram Stoker initially, and then he decided to call it Dracula instead. I guess the word existed in English before that, but meant something different, actually meant living, right? It just meant the opposite of being dead. So I guess it was Bram Stoker at the end of the 19th century that kind of initiated that usage. And certainly I'll say that, you know, if you look at the original D&D monster listing, right, they actually were designing these things in clumps. So the first eight or so is what you'd call humanoids nowadays. So things that kind of look like humans, they're evil goblins, orcs, ogres, up to giants. And then the very next block are all the undead in hit dice order, pretty much like we're looking in AD&D there. And then after that, there's kind of chimerical creatures like, you know, dragons and actual chimeras and stuff like that. So right off the bat, they did have these things in D&D organized. And you could almost say, I mean, the fundamental design choice was we're going to have some undead and they're going to have hit dice 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And we got to identify a name for each of those particular hit die categories is more or less where that comes from for D&D.
I feel like the undead, though, is the first case where you actually start to see game mechanics that are locking into a type. I guess humanoid, you do have things like, I don't know, charm person or hold person. We had the debate like what is and is not a person.
Right.
There's no text in the thing that says, hey, this first group of monsters are people or humanoids, right?
Maybe those words,
phrases don't really show up.
True. Maybe the ranger ability. Now, initially, right, through zero edition, first edition, they hadn't invented the word humanoid yet. So they were calling it giant class. The stuff that kind of looked like people that end with giants at the top end, they'd call it giant class. So you have the ranger ability, they get extra damage against all those types, stuff like that.
But it brings up kind of an interesting problem with the cleric's turning ability, right? Because, you know, the general text tells us that clerics can turn undead. And then we have this nice chart that shows us very specific, I'll put it back up, very nice specifically, like specific named monsters. And the problem I feel like this faces is that as the game expands and more creatures get added to the list, you start to go, well, where do those fit, right? If this creature is undead, should it be on this chart? Does it need its own separate line? Do we start going by hit dice? How does this work?
Good point. You know, and that's a point where not planning for modularity like that is a critique you could level at different places in original D&D. For example, the Charm Person spell had an explicit list of this monster A, B, C, D, E, F. These are the ones that are affected by it. And just exactly likewise, then you have this question about when we make up new monsters later, do they fit there or not, becomes unclear. I think that was, I think some later edition, they did key it to hit dice, like you're saying. That one I feel wasn't too hard because like the progression on this list, like you can see where the 20s go, is clearly a linear advancement. There isn't any room to insert more stuff. And so the new monster listings would always say, this monster is turned as a ghast, or this monster is turned as a specter, or whatever is what they do.
I mean, what I find interesting here is like I always think of this. Obviously, we're looking at the AD&D matrix here. Personally, when I think of turning undead charts, I think of the one in BX. I'm going to try and flip here to, I assume I'll find it here in my copy of OD&D, because originally it was a 2d6 chart, right? Not a d20 roll. And the number of creatures was fewer, right? I think that's why I got tripped up there by ghast versus ghost. I don't think ghast was in the list. It's almost like somebody's just trying to come up with monsters to slot into the missing hit die row.
Yeah. And I'll point out for some of our viewers, like what we're looking at on screen right now is the advanced D&D turning table. So this is first edition in the Dungeon Master's Guide is what we're looking at. And I think it was maybe second edition AD&D that added the hit die specifiers to the table. I'm just kind of educated guess where that started, I think.
They also, I don't know if this, again, I feel like this is so fascinating for me to talk to you about, Dan, because I'm always kind of curious, like, how much of this stuff have you just glossed over because you just kind of said, meh, forget the clerics. We don't need them. Is this part of it? Is this part of the reason why clerics are not appearing in your games?
It's certainly not appearing in this game. It absolutely is, right? And my if you look at my blog featured page, I think I have 15 reasons for not having clerics. And yeah, sure, this is one of the bullet points. Now, I will also say that it's not just me. You know, Gary regretted this, more or less. And, you know, I think we know the progression was back in some of the Blackmoor games, someone started playing a vampire, and then everybody was looking for defenses against the vampire. And then somebody invented the cleric class, more or less to act as Van Helsing as a counter to the vampire to begin with. Okay. And I think that Gary kind of regretted that later on. He wound up, you know, in his adventures, he would always have some location that tamped down the turning ability. Inevitably, the evil temple where the undead are has a magic effect that reduces the effectiveness of the turning, inevitably, or there's some kind of magic item that does that. And when he, you know, left TSR and started working on other games, he made a big vocal point of clerics in the later game, they're not going to have turning. You know, someone asked that, who was it? It was, Jerry asked this question right at the start of the show here. Let me put that on screen if I can. So Jerry was asking, well, Dan, if you play without clerics, do you also play without the undead, or are players more screwed than usual? Great question, Jerry. And the answer is the players are a bit more screwed than usual. And I feel like, you know, if undead are there and they're meant to be horrifying, terrifying, scary, the clerics kind of gimp that, kind of give you an easy out to that jump scare. And I don't mind digging in to a truly horrible situation that you don't have a perfect solution for. And I think Gary kind of agreed, because in his later designs, that's how he specifically said that you don't have a free get out of jail card with your clerics because they can't turn in my later games.
Interesting. I mean, you can see in the chart here, I don't know if you've ever bothered to look at this, but as we compare the original chart or the BX chart, but even by first edition AD&D, the abilities are getting tamped down quite a bit. For example, in OD&D, you only need to be fourth level cleric to start destroying skeletons. And in here, it goes all the way up to level 6 before you get that ability. So the charts... There, he was already making it harder to turn undead starting in first edition AD&D. And then the skeleton destruction is just an example, but the whole chart is definitely...
That's a little interesting. That's actually a point I hadn't actually seen. I mean, I just looking at this chart by itself, the first edition chart, my gut instinct is always like, you know, by the time you're at ninth level, you can just automatically destroy everything up to whites. You know, gas and wraiths are no problem. I mean, basically, you know, mummies, you're not going to fail to turn a mummy, really, or a specter. And so my experience when I did play with clerics was undead at the level basically get immediately wiped out by your clerics.
Which is, it's certainly a problem.
They did dial it down a bit.
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely one of the downsides of the cleric. And one of the, you know, personally, I love playing with undead as an enemy. I think, you know, they're spooky, they're creepy, they're weird. There's no conversation about the monster's morals, right? Because there's usually, when undead are featured in a game, and this is partly, I think, because of the progression we were talking about earlier of intelligence, right? They go from this, like, automaton to just this feral... evil creature that wants to destroy everything up until like some kind of Machiavellian, you know, and usual solo, right? Like you don't usually see adventures that feature like vampires in every room, right? And maybe you've got a small coven of vampires or a small group of vampires, but usually, okay, you know, it's just one vampire, if any, or one lich, right? And I kind of like that because it gives the players this ability to go against like just a truly Machiavellian enemy, you know, and then usually they're surrounded by lesser undead that they've probably summoned or created or whatever. And those things are just an extension of that villain's will.
Right.
Right. You don't,
right.
It's you don't very see compelling. That a ton. Right. And yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I like that. I like that storyline. And of course, clerics absolutely, you know, totally get in the way of that. It's super annoying.
They do. I'm glad you agree. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, at least in the turning side. Now I might start to talk about like, well, what can we replace turning with, right? Can we do something different, right? Rather than it's something I've struggled with a lot, honestly, because it's classic, right? People who have nostalgia for playing clerics, they like one of the first things that they think of, like the cleric can heal. And the second thing is the cleric can turn undead, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But maybe you could start to think of something like, well, look at, say, how rangers and their chosen enemies progressed, right? Like instead of the real problem, I think, with turning is this progression, or even just the straight up roll. Even when it's just a roll, it's a roll of either they're completely unaffected or they're almost completely neutralized. Right, it's just a binary of
yeah.
Whereas, like, if you look at say, like, how rangers get a chosen enemy, they just get bonuses to fight them, which is cool, but it doesn't just completely neutralize them. So I might start to look at that. Well, yep. Maybe clerics get a bonus towards undead, or you know, some other you know benefits that aren't just complete annihilation.
I could see that. That wouldn't be terrible. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean the turning, and I never liked even the destruction and the thing aside, just the actual act of turning, I never liked, because players, I think, always try to game it. They've always, every time I've been with players, they've been like, oh, well, we'll just get the cleric to turn them so that they have, and then we'll kind of chase them into a corner, and then we'll shoot them full of arrows, and then I'm stuck with this problem of like, okay, do I break the turn? Do I say that because they're cornered, they break out now, or do I just let the players destroy them? Because they've outwitted the undead. I don't know.
Interesting. And again, that's something I haven't dealt with in quite some time. Which way do you think you go normally with that? Do you let them?
Oh, the cornering? I usually have it break the turn. Like, well, the undead is cornered now, so it's not just going to huddle in the corner and let you shoot it full of arrows. It's going to just going to attack.
You know, I would, if I had clerics in the game and I hadn't pre-thought or had something, that's the kind of thing where I feel like, I think in that kind of situation, I do want, by default, kind of want to give the benefit of the doubt to the players, actually. And as a player, I get a little, I don't know. I've seen irritation more than once with a DM finding reasons to break the charm, break the turn, break the whatever. Mm-hmm. And I do tend to make those things more powerful rather than less, or dig into the power that's explicitly in original D&D. And I tend to have those things pretty robust if I don't have another reason beyond it. So I think I would actually let the people fill them full of arrows if they manage to get to that point. There's enough horrible stuff.
You know,
I'll get them later. It's fine.
I mean, you could just take the Gygax method and say, well, in this area, turning's less effective. Sorry, magic.
I would want to document that in advance. Right.
Yeah.
I would want to have that. I don't want to spring it on the fly, but I don't like to change power levels on the fly on an ad hoc basis because it's not balanced the way that I expected. I'm like, great. Didn't see this. Steamroll this one, players. You got me on this one. Yeah. You know, maybe I would do that if I documented it in advance. Sure.
Yeah. I'm more likely to want to just find a replacement for turning. Now, actually, let's talk about another aspect of undead, a case where I do actually replace the rule, and I think that maybe you don't, right? Which is level drain.
Level drain, like energy drain.
Coin. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to, in case there's viewers, right, we're in a situation now where we've played D&D. I've played D&D for so long that things that are part of my D&D may not be known to players that have starred in the last 20 years or so. So just in case players aren't, any viewers aren't aware, in Zero Edition, First Edition, Second Edition, kind of even Third Edition, you get hit by almost any undead from white up, and you just lost a level. It's gone. It's permanently gone. You're just losing levels. You might call that level drain or energy drain. So in Zero Edition, First Edition, Second Edition, there was nothing you could do about it. You get hit, the level's gone permanently. Players obviously hate that. There was a restoration spell. There was a top-level cleric spell called Restoration that could possibly get that back. But notice that that was added at the 7th level. So that spell is 2 levels higher than raising someone from the dead. It's harder to get a drained level back than it is to raise someone from actual extinction. And in original D&D, it even said it knocked the casting cleric out for 2 to 20 days, and therefore no NPC is willing to cast this. That's what it says.
Wild.
So wild. They made it real hard, and that has been dialed down over the years. In third edition, you could make a saving throw a day later to get it back, possibly. And then now in fifth edition, you never lose levels. The rule in fifth edition for those kinds of monsters is that you do you reduce your maximum hit points. So it's kind of basically like doing double damage, sort of. And then on your long rest, all of it goes away. Automatically. So that's gone from enormously punishing at the outset to kind of just double damage sort of now in fifth edition. So big change there.
Yeah. So again, with your game, no clerics, no 7th level spells.
No clerics.
No restoration. Restoration's just out, and so level drain is just permanent. Suck it up, players.
Okay, now here's a couple things. So you know me, Paul, I'm a big softy. I like my players, and despite my best intentions, I love all my players. Yeah. I like all their player characters probably more than I should. So in my old age, I do give a saving throw. So when one of the undead in my game, my house rule is when the undead hit you and you're about to lose a level, you do get a saving throw versus death at that point, which is the most liberal saving throw for what's worth. So there is an opportunity to avoid it. And the other thing is that I'm pretty careful these days of alerting them in advance that that's a threat. So I commonly play with a bunch of new players. They don't know all the classic lore of D&D. So when my players run into a white or whatever for the first time, I will outright say, this thing is evil. It feels like there's an evil aura just sloughing off it. And you have the sense that if it was even to touch you, it might drain your very life out of your body. And I kind of give clues like that for ghouls the first time they run into that. So I don't just surprise someone with, hey, there's a monster that sucks your levels away. Haha. I give them every opportunity in the book to be aware of that, to strategize around it. I do give them a saving throw, but other than that, the gloves are off. So if they let me get in contact and hit them, now their destiny is up to the dice.
I've personally get rid of it. I don't like level drain, and I have a couple of major problems with it. And it's not that I don't want to punish my players. I have a streak of evil DM in me, Dan. I like to do terrible things to my players. But here's my problem with level drain. Two major points, I would say. One is it's fourth wall breaking, right? It immediately makes us talk about the most gamey part of the game that really doesn't make sense in the fiction of the world, which is levels, right? We're going to talk about levels and levels of experience and how that somehow translates to life energy, which is weird. So you're saying that I get more life energy the longer I live? That is odd. It feels very gamey to me. It feels much more like a game mechanic than a world building element. That's problem number one. Problem number two for me is it's a lot of bookkeeping. And like, man, does that break the excitement and pacing and tension of a fight of like, oh, now I got to figure out how many hit points do I lose and what powers go away and what happens to my memorized spells. And right, there's just so many questions that just we're not prepared to answer in the snap of a moment. And nothing quite takes the steam out of an exciting, dramatic fight for me than, oh, let's do a bunch of bookkeeping so you can remove one of your levels and figure out what that means so we can move forward.
I'm very warm on the second argument. Okay, the first argument, it's funny because now we've had 2 weeks in a row where we get talking into do levels represent supernatural favors. We were totally talking about that last Sunday. But the second argument, I mean, is undeniable. I mean, you don't want a large amount of bookkeeping right in the middle of a fight. And that's a place where third edition actually had a reasonably good point in trying to address that. So in third edition, keeping the opportunity, the possibility of losing levels, what they did is they had this notion of a condition where basically you're at minus one to everything. So in the fight, they were calling it the negative level condition. You're minus one to everything, your hits, your saves, your whatever. I think you lose one top level spell. And then after the fight, for actually a day later, you do get a saving throw. And then if you fail it a day later, then it turns permanent. And then we're going to do the bookkeeping of rolling back the level. And that's a good point. And I actually kind of do, I think I actually do that now myself mid-game, is I actually do just say, you just lost a level, but for now, we're just going to say you're minus one at everything. And if you're a wizard, wipe out your currently top memorized spell. That's what I do mid-combat, basically inspired by the third edition rule, which does have a point to it.
Okay, I can see that. I don't know. It still feels clunky to me. Still not my favorite. My favorite option is actually comes from what I use is a resource from one of our favorite content creators to steal from, which is Dyson Logos. He used to write, he had a magazine or a zine that went out shortly called Dyson's Dodecahedron. I don't know that there were many issues of it ever, but in one of them, he included this thing called the Uniquely Undead Table. And it was just this big table of powers. And it was, it's absolutely for this problem. He says, if you don't like level drain, and for what it's worth, Dan, he's on your side. His beginning prelude says, yeah, I don't mind level drain. Okay. I have no problem with it.
Okay.
But a lot of people don't seem to like it, so here you go. Here's a big chart of alternate powers that you can, like, instead do. If you want to take level drain around away from your undead, but you still want them to be scary and horrible, you can roll in this chart and give them something else. And there's a whole bunch of really interesting stuff and very variable, right? There's all kinds of things in here, like maybe they can create darkness, or they can fly, or they have massive claws that do extra damage. They have vampiric drain. Here's one that you might like, Dan, that is Soul Wrench, the undead's blows are deadly. The target gets a save versus death. How do you like that? Death touch.
Zounds!
Save or die, sir. On every single attack is one of the entries. Yeah. Yep. Lots of good stuff. You know, we're only seeing the first page here. There's a couple of pages of it. And sometimes I'll roll on it, and sometimes I'll pick from it. And one of the things I like about it, too, is that it is exactly what the chart provides or claims on the label of the tin here is uniquely undead, right? If I use this for every time the players face a wraith, well, every one of my wraiths are slightly different, which is kind of cool.
Thumbs up. Kind of love it, frankly.
Yeah.
Do that.
I enjoy
that. There's starting with AD&D, there's the Banshee. Right. So AD&D starts having the ghost, the Banshee, and the Banshee is, screams and does automatic death. I always remember in first edition, it's like, oh, a Banshee is an evil female elf that's returned from the dead is what the what it says in the lore there, which I was very young and read that for the first time, like, very rare thing indeed is what it says. And I was like, yeah, that's right. That checks out. Now, I don't know if they know, I think in the last week or so, I was thinking, like, should your drow city be, like, full of lots of banshees? Is that an implication? I've never seen that, but now I'm like, I think I need more banshees in my Underdark type situation. And again, for something like that, I really want to communicate up front that there is that risk. I really don't want to have mid-combat me rolling for random unknown abilities and then find out that it's Death Touch when it's too late for anybody to respond to it. I think that's fine to have it on the table, but then I would make even more effort to communicate, find some way to clue them in advance so that's on the table.
Yeah, and if you're really on the ball, you could certainly like go through your adventure ahead of time and go, oh, I've got some undead here, let me roll some dice and pre-figure out what their abilities are rather than not until the moment, right? Because it is nice, right? Yeah, if I have, and that's, frankly, the Banshee Scream is on this chart, Dan. There, besides just Death Touch, there is also a Wail of Mourning. Yep,
right.
Seems like a banshee.
Right. And I think there's something in...
These are kinds of...
Go ahead.
These are things I would want to foreshadow in some way, right? I think that is fun,
yes.
Right? If I've got some undead, I might roll these ahead of time and write them down in my notes so that I can foreshadow a little bit that, oh, you know, you hear some distant wailing or something. You hear some strange echoes of cries through the hall or when you're still far away. Would be fun.
There's something in I think the monster. It's a monster manual too in first edition. I think it's the Bodak that is death gaze is what it has, I believe. So same kind of thing when I look at that. Like I look at those like death abilities and I'm like, yeah, okay, that's starting to push it for me. I'm going to find some way to let them at least know about it.
I mean, all the undead are pretty terrible, right? There's some chat going on in our some discussion in the chat right now that talks about how terrifying mummies are and they don't get enough love. Yeah, mummy rot. Great. Like the one and only reason to have and pack the cure disease spell.
Which,
that's nasty.
Yeah. Okay, now we need, you know what? We need, someday we need to do an episode of just about mummies.
Okay, we could do that.
The thing about mummies that I realized in my simulator that I call Arena that I use to simulate and determine like kind of what the how much experience you should get for like particular how dangerous particular monsters are. Mummies, I have an issue with mummies now because they, at least in original D&D first edition, they make for the longest fight. In my simulations. It's of everything in the entire classic D&D game, it's mummies that make for very long, very drawn out, slow moving fights on both ends. Because at least originally, they don't do that much damage. It's not like they have huge overwhelming attacks. They have a little bit of damage and they have damage resistance that massively reduces the incoming damage. So basically, everybody on both sides, it's almost like everybody has double hit dice for the mummy fight. And you might possibly have a mummy fight last 12, 20 rounds, possibly, if nobody figures out how to use the fire against them. And their special ability, I guess I'm just doing the episode right now. And their special ability, the mummy rot, is really just slow healing, which doesn't have an effect in the combat session, is a lingering effect afterwards. And as we've talked a number of times, healing is generally something that many of us just hand wave the time away anyway. So you might just go, okay, you got to rest 2 months instead of 2 weeks now. And I have a couple problems with, sometimes I think about how to make the mummy rot, I don't know, more interesting, more compelling or something like that. I have problems with mummies, actually. We need to do an episode about that to kind of debug my issues with mummies.
Great. Let's put a pin in mummies and we'll come back to that. We'll have a mummy episode maybe for Halloween or something.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Or Mother's Day. William or Mother's Day.
Excellent. I want to go back to, you know, there's, when you brought up Banshees, there was another problem that I have with Undead that I want to discuss a little bit, which is the sort of the origin, if you will, or the world building reason of how and why Undead exist and how they proliferate. So on the one hand, you've got the very low level stuff, very easy to find, right? We've got the Animate Dead spell. Mm-hmm. I can make skeletons and zombies. Perfect. At the very high level, they're generally self-creating, right? We assume horrible, evil magic users can turn themselves into liches. We know vampires, you know, suck the blood of people and turn them into vampires. But the mid-range, where do wights and wraiths and ghosts and specters and ghouls, I guess ghouls make ghouls, but where do the mid-range undead exactly come from? How does a female elf get turned into a banshee? How does that even happen?
Well, okay, now most the ones that were in original D&D, almost all of them spawn themselves. So ghouls, wights, wraiths, specters, they all make new versions of themselves when they kill people. You know, and then later stuff might not specifically mention that, like a banshee. That's a place where I very much don't mind that being a mystery that individual DMs can answer for their individual campaigns. So there's a little bit of discussion on the Discord server about how dangerous cats are, right? Right. And so I actually argued a little bit that cats can actually be a little bit dangerous. You notice that I am being gnawed on this very second with this this lovely creature that we are cat sitting. So there's maybe a hit point of damage right there from our lovely nephew. Isa.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. All right. Undead. I get that. How often have you seen let me start with this. Do you use the proliferation idea? If someone gets killed by a white, are they coming back as a white?
I wanted to ask you this actually. It's in the rules. I'm totally gonna do that. I don't think I've ever had that happen in any of my games.
Yeah.
Amazingly. I think it's happened at least once for you, right?
I have one, and it's so fascinating, right? Decades of play, I have one really good story about this, which involves ghouls, where my party, and specifically, it edges into the problem of raising the dead, right? Not the undead, not creating undead, but I was using, you know, raise dead was the only available way to bring characters back in my game, and in according to BX's raise dead, there's level limits or on how long the dead kind of existed. And so when my players were kind of mid-level, they obviously didn't have access to raise dead themselves, but they knew an NPC who could cast it, but he was just barely high enough level to cast it. So I think they had a limit of like 4 or 8 days or something to get a friend back from the dead. They're in the dungeon, which is a couple days march away from town. They're fighting ghouls. They're taking heavy, heavy losses, and they've decided they have to back out, and one of the characters gets knocked down by the ghouls, and they're in this, like, fighting withdrawal situation, so they actually have to abandon him. They're like, oh no, we have to leave his body. We have to leave him behind. We have to get out of here and save ourselves. So they retreat, and they know, right, from the combat, they knew, like, okay, well, he hit 0 hit points, like, he's dead, right? So the only way that this character is going to come back is if we get him raised. We have to bring his body back to town, and I think they also, we had a requirement that they had to have a very expensive gemstone, which I don't think they had access to at that moment, right? So they're trying to juggle all these different problems. They leave the dungeon, they recoup for a little bit, and they try to go back in, but I think it involved a trip to town and back. So they're really on the hair's edge of like, oh my god, we have to run, we have to go as fast as possible, get back into the dungeon, find the corpse of our friend, grab him, run him back to town, hopefully, you know, be able to resurrect him. And they get down there, and sure enough, I'm like, well, he's a ghoul. He's a ghoul now. He got killed by ghouls. He's definitely a ghoul. And they get down there, and there's still a pack of ghouls, including their friend. And they find, they figure out the loophole of, like, well, we just have to kill him. Like, raised dead is raised dead, man, right? Like, well, we'll just kill him. We'll kill him and all the ghouls, grab his body, and we'll run it back to town. And that's exactly what they did. And just barely managed to save him in the nick of time.
Nice.
But it was a fun, super. Like, they hadn't really considered that aspect of, like, what if he's a ghoul? And so that was, it was a fun moment for them to go down and go, oh no, our friend's a ghoul, and then have this little debate, and they quickly landed on, like, well, raised dead is raised dead, right? Raised dead is raised dead? I don't know. Let's kill him.
That's yeah. funny. That's funny. So yeah, it's on the table for me. It actually hasn't happened. I, you know, I clue in. I don't know if part of that is that most of our D&D play has had clerics on the table. And then, you know, more recently, I just have really, really good players, and I give them a bit of a clue, and they respond very aggressively, very aggressively to destroy the undead before it can touch anybody. Before, I want to talk a little bit about I want to touch on the question, and it was asked partly, it was asked on our Discord server this week of what exactly is, and maybe this is the direction you were going in with where, what is spawning or what is creating these undeads, the question of, like, what exactly is animating them? What is the in-world mechanic that causes them to be, you know, moving around? And, you know, and there, sometimes there's debate, and I don't know how much it's ironic or joking, but sometimes there's debate about, like, well, basically you're just reusing organs, aren't you? Isn't it a neutral thing to donate organs and just make use of the resources in the world around you? And isn't it, you know, arguably either good or evil based on what they're being used for? And certainly that's, you know, not what's baked into D&D initially. It's not the literature that inspired classic D&D or that I take inspiration from myself. And personally, I get a lot of inspiration from the Clark Ashton Smith story, Empire of the Necromancers, which is a great story, predates D&D. I'm familiar with it because of our friend Peter Bebergall's Appendix N anthology. Great, great book. I think he's got a volume 2 out last year, I believe. And so Empire of the Necromancers is a really great look at, you know, two necromancers that basically take over a devastated Egypt-type world. It's repeatedly, you know, bringing people back as undead is repeatedly referred to as an abomination and tyrannous and sinful and every dark word you could possibly come up for it. And basically it's, you know, people, you know, there's a couple passages from the perspective of the undead servants of these guys. And basically it's people who were at rest who are now brought out of their rest and enslaved is basically the situation, the dim awareness of the undead. And it's not a happy situation. It's clearly an evil situation. And, you know, the sources that I read, I also am a big fan of John Steakley's Vampires with a dollar sign, kind of informs my understanding. And, you know, just in the last week, I happened to watch the film Shadow of the Vampire with Willem Dafoe, for what it's worth. I think it's a 2000 film. In which it's a fantasy retelling of the making of the original Nosferatu film. And in all of these works, and it really hit me in the right place, because in all of these works, the vampires are horrible garbage scum, right? They're not charming. They're not glittery. They're horrible rat-like vermin. And they have all, and Shadow of the Vampire does this a great job of this, of a decrepit, truly wretched, not very smart, you know, reduced piece of garbage who has all the charisma of a zombie ant fungus, basically. So for me, the undead are by default, they're like that. they're fundamentally a disease on the human race.
When you hear those arguments of like, oh, I'm just reusing body parts, right? Like, it only kind of makes sense at the lowest level of undead, right? Again, that sort of scale of the intelligence or autonomy of the creature going up, right? Like, okay, yes, maybe to make a zombie, maybe you're only using its organs and its spirit or its mind is elsewhere. Although you could certainly just say like, no, it's trapped in there and totally unable to do what it wants, right? You know, you're raising up Aunt Gertrude and Aunt Gertrude is now trapped in this horrible, you know, mindless, you know, haze and forced to do the bidding of the necromancer that raised them. Yeah, that's horrifying, right? But that quickly vanishes, right? Once you get into these more like the whites and the rays who are twisted and warped and evil and want to kill and destroy. Even Anne Rice's vampires are kind of self-loathing, right? Of sort of like, it's a curse.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, I get to live forever, but I can't go out in the sun and all my friends die and I have to watch them die. And like, it's actually like living forever kind of sucks and I have to kill people to survive. And yeah, it's gruesome. It's gruesome, right? Not something you would or wish on anyone. Yeah.
Right.
But I want to go back to your original question of like, how are they created, right? This is exactly what I was trying to get at earlier. I do love the enemy of the evil necromancer who's like, I'm going to raise an army of the dead to like do my bidding and take over the world. I think that's super compelling. It's a fun thing. And the only mechanic I have to support that is animate dead. So he can only have skeletons and zombies, right? Like, how does my evil necromancer get wights and wraiths and ghouls to serve him, right? There's no mechanic to support that, and I just have to make up some nonsense, right? Which is fine. I can make up some nonsense. I can do that. But I do sort of want to answer the question, like, well, how does it happen, right? How does the most powerful lich in the world create wraiths to act as his generals?
It's a good point. As of Advanced D&D, right, as a first edition, there is a rule that, you know, assuming you have clerics, your evil clerics can swap out turning for, or can swap out destruction for domination. So they actually can possess, not a vampire, I guess, but they actually can take over some types of undead for maybe a limited amount of time. That's a place where I actually feel like I don't mind. You know, we have explicit rules in all the early editions that you can invent your own spells. And some of the earliest players, some of the people that were at Gary or Dave's tables, will occasionally argue that obviously there's a spell to do that in the world. And I guess I don't want to push it that far, but I do want to give it as an opportunity. You know, there's going to be some, look, I don't need every vile thing spelled out explicitly in the rule books, particularly for really, really evil, foul crap. You know, depending on at your table, how, you know, willing your players are to dig into the horror element one way or the other. That's something I feel the DM can roll out for their table. So just, you know, if there's a fifth level spell that takes over ghouls and specters, beautiful. Love it.
Yeah. My problem with it usually is not that it doesn't exist and is written down. It's just that often I find myself with not enough time to contemplate, right? Like that's really the problem. I have this evil necromancer, I created this whole adventure. He's got this army of the undead. The players go through his lair and kill a large percentage of his undead, but don't manage to kill the necromancer, and then they retreat. Now I've got a week to plan next session, and I go, how does he recoup? What does he have to do to get some forces back? I don't know, right? And what's realistic? And the problem is I haven't thought about it ahead of time either, so now I'm like, you know, I feel like I'm, you know, putting the need of the plot ahead of the need of the simulation of the fantasy world, so it's end up in a bad design space, I think. So I would love to bother to sit down at some point and kind of map out, okay, how could a horrible lich of, you know, maximum level, how would they raise an army? How would they recoup if half their army was destroyed? What is the process?
I will say Despero in the chat is reminding us that, certainly over the years, there were supplements that had extra spells to address exactly that. I do have a copy of the Wizard's Spell Compendium, which is a 4-volume set, came out in the 90s, that attempted to compile every spell in every edition of D&D to that point. So it meant to have original D, first edition, and second edition spells with all the supplements all piled into one massive encyclopedia. And it has a whole suite of, you know, more undead, more animate undead, and greater animate undead, and something else, and something else. So they have spells. Somebody spent some time thinking what spell level should make gas, ghosts, or whites, or specters, or something like that. So sometimes when I have a problem like that, I go to the Wizard Spell Compendium and go, would this work for my game to add to it?
I'll have to check that out. I do think, though, that I don't want it to just be a progression of higher level spells. Oh, you just need the right spell at the right level. I kind of want it to be gruesome, right? I kind of want to be able to say, yep, the Necromancer, in addition to having cast this spell, it's got some component of it that is something really, truly unpleasant that no normal person would actually do.
I want that in these.
In these spells, and they in these might, effects. Maybe they exist, maybe not. I don't know. But that I would like that to exist.
I'm trying to grab one of these out of that book.
We'll have to, Dan, we'll have to save it for a subsequent show. Because
dang it!
We are,
dang it! Oh, dang it! God, it's just as I... Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. How do they do that? Excellent. Well, I guess I'm going to have to wait for another episode to find out.
Save it for another episode. Dan, any final thoughts on the undead?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think they're super compelling for a whole lot of reasons. I want them to be horrible. I hang on to the energy drain. I want my players to be more aware that they're horrible rather than less. I don't want it to be a surprise. I want to hit the players with the dread. That's the whole point for me of the undead. They kind of break some rules. They're not subject to charm persons or a whole bunch of like standard spells. So I want them in my game. I want them horrible. Yes. Part of the reason I wipe out clerics is specifically to make undead more horrible in my games. I do not regret it. The undead are horrible, garbage, scum, vermin. And my one of my players' top jobs is to destroy the undead. And that's what happens in my games.
Yeah. You know, honestly, it's one of the more compelling reasons I've heard for getting rid of clerics, honestly. And as part of, I think, one of the strongest reasons for me to want to get rid of them. That said, if I was going to run clerics, I think it would also be the first thing that I want to house rule. Is I would want to change, get rid of turning undead, because I'm not a fan of that. Not a fan of turning undead. Not a fan of level drain for the reasons I pointed out. Again, things that I think are that can be worked around. You can alter house rule, change up your game to suit your needs. But yeah, I agree. I want them to be horrible. Again, I don't want to get rid of level drain because I think it's too painful or too unpleasant for the players. I want the undead to be painful and unpleasant to the players. My main gripes with it are more just about the pacing and the impact of the story of the world building. And I'd rather, hell, just give them death touch. Sure, why not? Straight up death touch.
It's easier to recover from. It. There's that.
Viewers,
Dyson's table is
opinions,
great.
Yeah, it's a good one. I recommend it. I think you can just find it on his website if you just search for Uniquely Undead. I don't think you have to dig up his publication. Although you can. I think it's on probably on DriveThruRPG. Go hunting for Dyson's Dodecahedron. It's issue number 3, I believe, if you were looking for that. Viewers, if you have opinions on the undead, how to use them, how to make them, how they interact with clerics, or maybe if you know some solutions, you have some solutions for me on how to create an evil necromancer NPC who can raise the undead as a giant army, and how that necromancer would recoup from the losses that are inevitable when facing the players, let us know. Drop us a note here in the comments section of this YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. And maybe we will have an episode number 2 on undead, or at least one on mummies.
Definitely, among other things. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and anathematize that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various third-party carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our private Discord server, where the conversation with our smart, intelligent, wise, hardworking, attractive patrons continues 24/7 about everything old school, new school gaming, all kinds of good ideas that I get from my games and solutions to other people's problems. Just wonderful stuff. And access to our after party video chat that we'll be holding in about 10 minutes there on Discord. So I'll be looking forward to a lot of chat went by today that I didn't see every single thing. So I'm looking forward to additional pointers from our patrons. Now, I am told that Paul needs to run today because he's got a heavily scheduled day booked of running other games. So I believe he needs to run out to the car and run to his next gaming engagement. Is that right, Paul?
I'm just waiting for you to shut up so I can do it.
I'll be there. I'll see everybody else in the after chat. So please don't forget, we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.